subject that law, policy, and society program at Northeastern. She began her professional life as an English teacher, a surprise to me until I read this today, in high school and college levels, switched to criminology and criminal justice in her mid-30s, and earned her PhD from the School of Criminal Justice at SUNY Albany. She wrote one of the school's first historical dissertations, and then in 1977 began teaching at Northeastern University's College of Criminal Justice, where she developed one of the country's first courses on women and crime, and later one of the first courses on crime films and another on biological theories of crime. I'm a fan. Nikki's published 15 books, I believe. I met her over one of her earlier books called White Trash. Let me give you the complete title. The Eugenic Family Studies, 1877 to 1919. So the reason I'm introducing Nikki is because I've known her for about 20 plus years, and we were introduced over a mutual interest in the history of eugenics, which I came to from studying the Nazi Holocaust, and Nikki came to out of her work in groundbreaking work in criminology, and was looking at the use of eugenics in this country to justify stereotyping and criminalization of unfavorable peoples. So I had just found out about the roots of eugenics as it pertained to this country and was quite blown away by the extent of the eugenics history here and how this was the home of eugenics until the Nazis discovered it and took it and, as some people say, gave it a bad name. But anyway, we were introduced over this mutual interest, and out of that came colleagueship, friendship, and an incredible experience for me of working on two exhibitions with Nikki on criminal stereotyping, the history of criminal stereotyping, and biological theories of crime, and culminating in the second show, which was called Searching the Criminal Body, Art, Science, and Prejudice, and was a show that brought together pseudoscience and art, and was one of the more fascinating things I've done in my life. So Nikki has inspired me and really amazed me since I've known her all this time, and her mind, I hope, will enrich your evening as well. Nikki Rafter.
Well, thank you all for coming out, and thanks to the Writers' Center, Susan and Henry in particular, for giving me a really blissful week in this studio. Let me tell you a little bit about the topic I'm going to be talking about is genocide films and collective memory. Let me tell you a little bit about how I got interested in the topic of genocide films. I've written a couple of books on crime films. I really like to watch movies. And then several years ago, I started working on a book on genocide. I'm still working on it. That's what I'm doing here at the Writers' Center. And one day I realized that these two things could go together. So I asked a colleague, a friend of mine, Michelle Brown, who teaches at University of Tennessee, to work with me on an article on genocide films. It was just published today in the British Journal of Criminology. And so this talk derives from that work. In the paper, we argue that genocide films play an important role in collective memory, helping us remember and think about events that are basically unthinkable. These events are also pretty much inaccessible to most of us, not to you entirely, because you came to this country after World War II, but most of us haven't lived through a genocide. And so most of us can't understand or remember genocides of the past in any direct manner. We began by distinguishing between two types of genocide films, the commercial and the critical. The commercial ones, commercial type of genocide films, those are the most prevalent. They're mainly made in Hollywood. They use genocide usually as a kind of background context for a romance or something else that's happening in the foreground. They have very sweeping narrative lines. Their endings are often bittersweet, sometimes comforting. I include Schindler's List in this category of commercial genocide films. I realize that the Holocaust is central to that film, not just background, but I fault Schindler's List in some ways, mainly because of the ending. It ends up with this very kind of high, comforting ending where you not only hear that these people survived, the people whose story you've learned about, but then lo and behold, the director brings the real people who were played by movie stars onto the set, and you see that they're all still alive today. Other things in this category of commercial genocide films, I put The Pianist, a film that I think won an Academy Award a couple of years ago, and the film Hotel Rwanda. Also, again, genocide's key there, but it's a very much a narrative story with a hero and a lot of other traditional movie elements. Critical genocide films, which is the type I'm going to be focusing on here, these are usually less commercially successful. They're often documentaries, or they have a documentary kind of format. And these are the films that establish for us the iconographies that we use, the images that we've got in our heads when we think of genocides, either particular ones like the Holocaust, or about genocides in general. For example, Night and Fog, which is one of the two films that I'll be showing the excerpts from this evening, directed by Alain René, it has actual footage from the Holocaust. For a while, it was the only available genocide film, and people watched it very carefully. Had footage from the time when the Allies went in and opened up Auschwitz and other death camps, and other images of Auschwitz that then were used in a whole lot of other films. They've circulated a lot. Similarly, if any of you've seen Claude Lanzmann's film called Shoah, anybody, you've seen it? Yeah. Well, because he went to so many of the sites, he doesn't use original footage, but he shows you the insides of so many concentration camps that those images, too, became available through the movie that he made. So these critical genocide films, they shape not only how we picture genocides, but I think they also shape the kinds of questions that we ask when we think about these atrocities. Both types of genocide film, and I don't want to say the first type is worthless, both of them raise ethical questions, but the commercial type often derive their iconography from the more critical films, and they also don't pose as questions that are as difficult as the ones that we get from the critical genocide films. For example, have any of you seen a film called The Battle for Algiers?
Yes.
Fabulous film, right? Gilles Pontecorvo. Yeah. Just one of the best films ever made, I think. And there, you're forced to identify with a terrorist, the lead character with whom you sympathize completely is a terrorist. So that film raises very complicated ethical issues about what we should do in a situation such as that man found himself in, the French in occupying Northern Africa. In Enemies of the People, a Cambodian film, a film about Cambodia that is made by a Cambodian, and one of the other ones, the second one I'll show this evening, we see the main character, the film director, he actually becomes friends with Nguyen Che, who is brother number two, the right-hand man of Pol Pot. So there we're sitting down to dinner with this old man, and the film has a very complicated ethical stance toward him. So what I'm saying is that critical genocide films really raise difficult questions about witnessing and remembering, and also the possibility of closure. What Michelle and I argue in our paper, and what I'm going to be arguing here this evening, is that critical genocide films play an important social role. They give us access to genocides of the past. They keep them alive for us. They force us or help us to remember them. And they also guide us toward key issues, such as the one that everybody always asks about genocide. How could they do it? What happened during a specific genocide? Who was killed? Why were they killed? How were they killed? And who could this atrocity have been prevented? So I want to begin with Night and Fog. This is the one that was directed by the Frenchman Alain René. It was released in 1955, not very long after the end of World War II. It was almost the first film to address the Holocaust. There was an earlier film. I haven't been able to get hold of it. It was made by a Polish woman who'd been held at Auschwitz, and bang, not the minute the war was over, it seems, she made a mock-up of this, she made a set reproducing as accurately as she could Auschwitz as she knew it, and she made this film based on her memories as an Auschwitz survivor. But I'd give a lot of money to see that film, but I haven't been able to buy it. That came out in 1948. Public memories and understandings of the Holocaust had not yet solidified at the time that René was given the commission to make Night and Fog. There was no accepted narrative line. There was no accepted ideological line. For example, it was not even clear yet that this was a genocide that had mainly, a set of genocides that had mainly targeted Jews. Nor was it clear yet how many other groups the Nazis had tried to exterminate, such as the so-called gypsies and people with mental disabilities, who are the ones that we have a long-term
relationship around.
Yeah. They brought us together, Susan. And so René was given this assignment. He studied a lot of history. He had to think about a lot about the issue that is central to anybody who's going to make a film about genocide, which is how do you portray something which is maybe unportrayable, unthinkable? How do you show an event that may be unshowable? What René decided to do was to use original Holocaust footage. That's the black and white part of his film. And he also used some stills. I don't know if you know, but there were 6 photographs taken from within Auschwitz during the Holocaust by some Jews who worked in the photography unit. And Do you remember I gave you a book once with some women in it on the ramp, naked women? Mm-hmm. It's one of those six stills. And I don't think that any of them show in the section I picked out tonight. But those are very valuable films. He didn't know at the time how rare they were. And he also, Rene, decided to use, he was trying to show us that threshold between life and death. And what he did was he photographs the stacks of clothing, which were still there, the hair, and other effects that were left over, and incorporates those into his film. He refused to make the film unless he could collaborate on it with a man named Jean Cairol. He was a survivor of the Mauthausen-Gusen concentration camp complex in Austria. And Cairol is the person who's narrating this film. It's in French, but it's got English subtitles. Night and Fog is only half an hour long in its entirety, and I'd love to show you the whole thing. But since there isn't time for that, I'll show you material from the start and from the end of the film. So we'll begin with the start, but before Henry gets there, I want to ask you, when you're looking at the very first shots in this film, watch what the camera does. It's as though it has its head up, down, up, down. When it's up, you see a landscape without a concentration camp in it. And then an inch down, it flops down a little bit, and there you see barbed wire. I think he does this three times in the introduction to this film. So what he's trying to do is to get us to imagine a world without Auschwitz and to think of what it meant to introduce this horror into this landscape. So Henry, why don't we play the first bit?
Why don't you talk a little bit more on it, because I'm waiting for the computer to talk to this machine here.
That's a long talk.
Here we go.
Oh, good. I've saved.
All right.
So he's walking us into Auschwitz. It might be a good idea. That lamp over there has a light in. Oh, yeah, this one's maybe more. Yeah, you found it. Okay.
But you need to see.
Mm-hmm. You need to be able to read.
Oh, wait a minute. It's not going to the screen. Hold on.
Do you want a light, Henry?
No. It's
you got the music.
Yeah, but it's only showing half of the image for some odd reason. Hold on a sec.
I'm sure that given all you were able to do earlier today, you're able to fix this. Excuse me. Do you want to take have a little bit of the light?
No, I don't need that.
You don't?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, but Rachel seems to be gone. All right, well.
That's later.
Yeah.
Oh, you're almost there. Okay,
yeah,
you're
yeah.
almost there.
Hold on.
You're doing well, except for that.
Hold on. Screen. Oh, yeah.
Brilliant.
No, it's still on back to half. Mm-hmm. See, remember I told you, Nikki, we'll get this all set up, it'll be perfect.
Yes.
And when it gets to the point where we're actually showing it, something will screw up, so.
And do you remember I told you that every time I show a film that this happens?
All right, so.
I'm just glad you're doing it. Usually I'm the one who's there fumbling around and not knowing what I'm doing.
Why is it showing on here? It's coming up. Okay, if everyone would bear with me, I just want to reboot this machine, which will hopefully.
We're in no hurry.
All right.
You You know, it's not a disaster if you play it like this.
That would be good.
Yeah. Who are you saying that to?
You can do it the way you had it before.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see.
Try command. Just pull that down.
Yeah.
There.
Oh.
Try command F. It might just go out. Command F.
Yeah.
No, it's
there you
did
it.
Full screen, but only zoom in half of it.
Wow.
Oh. Yeah.
I see the shape of the projector.
Yeah. So what are we doing?
Is it the film aspect that you're trying to get? I think you go to control properties, screen aspects. Well, I just this afternoon was doing it on my computer.
So
yeah. All bluey. Such a strange light that he caught there.
Yeah.
Good.
Let's see if I got all of it in there. No, there's still some of it that's not in there.
Whoops, I keep doing that. Sorry. It's too bad you can't flip over the top of that.
You can't. That'll slide over.
Oh, there you go. Alright, so let's try it now. Excellent.
Sorry for the lousy quality.
There is a menu so you can begin at the beginning. I think we're close enough now to. Okay, here we go.
Peuvent conduire tout simplement à un camp de concentration. Le Struthof, Oranienburg, Auschwitz, Neuengamme, Belsen, Ravensbrück, Dachau furent des noms comme les autres sur les cartes et les guides. Le sang a caillé, les bouches se sont tues, les blocs ne sont plus visités que par une caméra, une drôle d'herbe a poussé et recouvert la terre usée par le piétinement des concentrationnaires. Le courant ne passe plus dans les fils électriques, plus aucun pas que le nôtre.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to the last scene now. He does color in the present and black and white is for the past by necessity. So you see how he walks us in the film, the camera keeps moving in this direction through most of the movie. So You can't get to the menu. It works so well earlier
we
today.
Those other things around.
Okay, don't
want to.
Okay.
Way, so.
Well. It's quite near the. It's a 30-minute movie,
okay,
so it'll be probably there. It's liberation. It's the.
Unfortunately, it's not giving me the chapters now for some
no.
reason. Let me see if I can go to here.
Did you get a control for it?
I don't know.
That's one of the ovens. Those of you who haven't been there. What I should tell you that the
it's
first.
Don't
worry, Henry. I should tell you that it's a bit grim. The first part of the last section that I'm going to show you, because on liberation here, as in other camps, there were a lot of dead people lying around, and for sanitary reasons, they had to take care of the bodies. So, but it only lasts 1 minute. I just saw the menu.
Yeah, I'm trying to get there.
Okay. No pressure.
So
who is responsible? Six.
Okay.
Yeah, very good. Okay. So the Allies have come in, and the Germans are being marched out. So shut your eyes if you want to. 1 minute. It's over.
Les déportés regardent sans comprendre. Sont-ils délivrés? La vie quotidienne va-t-elle les reconnaître? Je ne suis pas responsable, dit le capot. Je ne suis pas responsable, dit l'officier. Je ne suis pas responsable. Alors, qui est responsable? Et hors d'usage. Les ruses nazies sont démodées. 9 millions de morts hantent ce paysage. Qui de nous veille de cet étrange observatoire pour nous avertir de l'avenue des nouveaux bourreaux? Ont-ils vraiment un autre visage que le nôtre? Quelque part parmi nous, il reste des capots chanceux, des chefs récupérés, des dénonciateurs inconnus. Il y a tous ceux qui n'y croyaient pas, ou seulement de temps en temps. Il y a nous qui regardons sincèrement ces ruines, comme si le vieux monstre concentrationnaire était mort sous les décombres, qui feignons de reprendre espoir devant cette image qui s'éloigne, comme si on guérissait de la peste concentrationnaire. Nous qui feignons de croire que tout cela est d'un seul temps et d'un seul pays, et qui ne pensons pas à regarder autour de nous, et qui n'entendons pas ton cri sans fin.
That's one person's approach to one director's approach to the problem of how do you represent something that maybe can't be represented or shouldn't be, and how do you get people to think about the issues involved in a short film. The voice over there by Cairole at the end forces us to think about these difficult questions. He says, "Who amongst us is still watching in this strange observatory to warn us of the coming of new executioners?" And then he says, "Are their faces really so different from our own?" Which is a pretty brave thing to say in 1955. It's the same thing that Primo Levi said not too long later in his book, The Drowned and the Saved. That's one approach. My second example is less horrific. It's a 2009 film made by a Cambodian, a young man named Phet Samvath. It's a very different kind of movie, although I guess, my guess is that Phet Samvath had seen Night and Fog, because he lingers a lot on water. Remember the last scene that we just saw there with the frozen pond, and you think about what's underneath it. And even more than René, Phet Samvath looks at the surfaces of water and asks you to think of what would be beneath them. He lost his mother, his father, and his brother, his whole family, to the Khmer Rouge during the Cambodian genocide, which took place in 1975-1979. So he was a little boy when it happened. He's a photographer at the time the film is made. He's a photographer for a local newspaper. But he took breaks from his regular job, and he started going out into the countryside to befriend peasants who've been cadre under the Khmer Rouge and he suspected had been involved in the executions. And he gets them to talk. He gets them to talk on film. This is an autobiographical film. He takes along a photographer to film him seeking for answers to his questions about the genocide, and to watch him as he comes to terms with his own loss and with his country's loss. And the camera is not always complimentary to him. He has one scene where he's not in it, and he's going off to get in a car with his photographer and his helper, and his wife says, "I'd like some money to feed the kids." And he says, "I don't have any." So he's spending the family's income on this strange hobby that he has, filming a genocide that was over a long time ago. So he implicates himself in a kind of guilt. In the course of his investigations, he meets with Nguyen Che, brother number two, and becomes good friends with him. So what I'd like to do, if we can bring this off, is to show you four excerpts from this film, from the beginning and the very end, as we did with Night and Fog, and then two scenes from the middle, one where he tells you how he gets people to talk to him, and then another one where peasants are talking to him and telling him what they did and how they feel about it. So this is, again, a time when I'm very happy Henry's doing this and not me, because I could never do it, but I always get very agitated, too. So it's hard to call up the scenes on this film. Well, I thought it was. Henry was good at it.
That was
earlier.
A bad dress rehearsal, I'm sure, is a good performance. Vice
versa. This is why you should all go get more wine and cookies and pretzels. Should I do this now?
Yeah.
to make everybody read this before they
Yeah, we there's no way to escape this. And because the film's a little bit defective in the menu, I have read that warning probably 60 or 70 times, trying to key into the scenes. And so it was released, and it became a sensation. It got wonderful reviews. People went to cinemas and saw it. Okay, good. Great. See the water, rice paddies. So we want scene one. That's good. Oh gosh. As I said, this film is not without its problems. Okay. Maybe it'll roll for a while.
Some say that almost 2 million people die in the killing field. Nobody understands why so many people were killed in that town.
ในปีแรกผมจะสำลับก็ไม่จะกินเยอะเลยจำนวนสำลับนั่นคือที่ไทยไม่ไทยสำลับคือโดยจะเร่งคือเตรียมเตรียมนอนสมัยเคยคิดเตรียมว่าสำลับคือยังไม่นอนเลยนอนสำลับนอนสำลับคือไงนายคือนอนเมาคืออารมณ์สำลับ
So that's brother number two, his friend.
I just know that in Popol Vuh, only a rich man, no chief, can tell us why the killing happened. My project is to find out why so many people died in the killing field. I do this work not just for my father, my mother, and my brother. I do this for all the people.
Okay, that's the end of the first scene. Let's see if we can go to scene six. Good, brilliant, okay. I assume this is Phnom Penh, I don't know.
To find all these people. Because after Khmer Rouge collapse, these people did not follow Pol Pot anymore. they just go to live in other village and different province quietly, not join with Meru anymore. Some people I take a long time. I take 1 year or 2 years or 3 years just to know them closely. That when I go to meet them, just say hello and talking with their children or their wife, make a funny, and then we have a chat a little bit, and then I go back. After I get close, I let them drink wine and enjoy together, and then they start. I start talking about the Khmer region. I heard some people, they kill a lot of people, they kill in that way. And then that man said, oh, you want to know? I know. I also did it. Some people, they answer to me like that, and then I keep quiet. I do not ask him anymore. Next week, I went to see him, and then I start talking. Did he kill the people or not? And then I say that I know for a long time about some people who kill, and I know that you kill the people too, but I did not to ask you, so I'm sorry to you. So now I just here to ask you, we are going now, we are confident of each other.
Okay, so this is where the complicated...
To get the truth, you must talk to the unbeachable.
Oh, I'm sorry.
This is the third excerpt.
Right.
It's the one with the numbers.
Right.
Here.
30. Well, we're right just about there.
Okay, it should be pretty close.
Yes.
You just let it run.
Yeah.
It's so interesting how he did it.
It's hard for foreigners and journalists to talk to them. But for me, it's no problem. Because I am a contribution. They already know. But you must find another way.
Here we
are.
ติ๊กๆนั้นมันพูดทําให้เกิดแล้วมันเจ็บ
Okay, and maybe we could then go straight to the last scene, right at the very end. No.
No.
No, it's the very, very last one. It's hard to. Oh, yeah. Okay, so there it is, 13. 13.
I won.
13?
Yeah. Excuse me, this. I can't read these. 18. 18. There you go. Yeah, he's standing in the right field.
I had bought some land along the border. I planned to plant some fruit trees, some potato, and some corn. Now the project is finished, I plan to stop and take a rest. I need to stop researching the past. I would like to spend more time with my family, my children, my wife, and concentrate on farming the land.
And that's it. So this film really does have some closure with him walking off like that. Those are two different approaches toward this very difficult problem of how do you represent a genocide. to conclude, I want to draw on the concept of collective memory. This is a concept that was formulated by a French sociologist named Maurice Halbwachs. He taught in Paris, and he was arrested by the Nazis. He was a leftist. He was arrested just before the end of World War II and taken to Buchenwald. He was quite an old man by that point, and he died there just 6 weeks before liberation. Halbwachs used this term collective memory to denote shared memory. It's a parallel on the group level to what we have on the individual level with our individual memories, but he used it to talk about how a group can have a memory. Groups, unlike most of us, can get together and make memorials and do things collectively to remember their past, to commemorate these atrocities. I think that group memories, collective memories, are really essential to the health of a group or a nation, if you want. They're the way the group understands its history, and they're central to people's social thinking. And I think this is where the films come in. These are widely accessible vehicles for collective memories. They repeat, replay, or recreate the atrocities. They're really the only source of memories for some groups. You heard the informant there saying, I want this film to be shown everywhere in this country, every village, every province, and so on. And I think it's only if a group can remember its past that it can take steps to prevent this kind of atrocity from recurring. And only if it remembers the past can it take steps to preserve the memory of the people who died in the atrocities. So I'm sure you have questions or comments. I told Henry that's the part I like about giving talks. So I'd like to hear, there are a lot of artists among you deal with issues of visual strategy all the time, and I'd love to hear what you your reactions are.
Well, right at the beginning, when you were saying that Alain Resnais was sort of, and all the films deal with the issues of how to represent such horrible things using an art form. And that does, it transcends all the genres, you know, visual art, film, music, everything, and literature. And what you just said at the end about collective memory and the film's role in that, when I put the two together, seemed very interesting to me, because most of the other art forms don't reach the kinds of audiences that the films do. Mm. And I hadn't really thought about genocide films in the sense of, I mean, I've thought about them in terms of helping society work through the past, but not in a way to help societies form an identity around the past. And I don't know, it just seems like a very new way of thinking about their role, which is extremely interesting to me. You know, I was going to, in the introduction, talk a little bit about, which I completely didn't do, about what you're working on now. And one of the things I didn't say was that it is, as I understand it, very new to look at genocide through the viewpoint of criminology.
Completely.
Right.
Criminology. Oh, we only do street crime.
Right.
Maybe, well, a little white collar crime, but not that big stuff.
So,
yeah.
I'm wondering how, I don't know how this, how the film part factors in, if it does, to your thinking about the viewpoints from a criminological stance on genocide. And I'm not even sure that the question I'm asking makes complete sense at the moment. I'm trying to put the two together and see how the films inform your thinking in terms of this new way of considering genocide and maybe a new approach to dealing with perpetrators.
Yeah, well, it seems like there are a lot of questions in what you said.
There are many.
Yeah. Oh, I should have turned this, shouldn't I? Toward
That's
her.
All right, we'll get it.
Okay, I'll learn.
I'm trying to just put it on.
Well, what I learn a lot from these films. That helped me. I mean, I'm writing a comparative study of 8 genocides, which is a really dumb idea, and the manuscript's terrible, and I'm struggling a lot with it up here. It's too many for people. For my readers to keep in mind at once, but for me to understand 8 genocides, it's, I mean, all I have are books in most cases. You know, I've been to some concentration camps in Austria, but that's the old fallacy of the Holocaust, which everybody thinks is the norm, you know, but it's really an outlier. It's very different from other genocides. So these give me access to Cambodia, and I mean, when will I ever talk to a Cambodian peasant and get that person to speak? I also use them a lot in my teaching. I've started teaching a course called Crimes Against Humanity, and whenever I can, I assign a film on genocide. Just to follow up on one other thing you sort of said, one of the things you were mentioning. There's a brand new genocide film out that I just saw last Friday night. It's in Boston. It's at Kendall Square right now. And it's about the Indonesian genocide of 1965 when Suharto came in. And he just said, oh, kill all the communists. Indonesia had the biggest communist party outside of China and the Soviet Union in the world. And the country got polarized between the right, the army, and the communists, and Suharto took over, and not only did he commit a genocide, I mean, between 500,000 and 1 million people killed, at least, and then probably over 1 million detained and tortured, including women gang-raped constantly, but he told them that nobody can talk about this, and anybody who talks about it gets to go to a detention center. So even people say now, even in our own families, we couldn't tell what had happened to us. So it's like a stopper in this bottle of memory. Suharto was ousted in 1998. People started talking out, and this movie was made, but it interviews the perpetrators. And they're old men now. They're people who love movies. They used to scalp tickets at movies when they were small-time gangsters, and then they were brought into the genocide, and they killed a lot of people. And they stage how they killed the different people according to different film genres. So sometimes they're in a horse with a cowboy hat, and we did it this way. I mean, they really did think about these things, apparently. I mean, it's the most bizarre film. So this is a long way of telling you. So I have a friend in Australia who's a specialist on this genocide. And I said, she wrote to me just yesterday, and she said, the film is banned in Indonesia. It's called The Art of Killing. It's banned, she said, but that doesn't matter, because in Indonesia there are lots of illegal copies made. She said, everybody's seeing it. Everybody's talking about it. And so it's a way for a whole country, going back to what you were saying, a whole country can suddenly begin to look at some of this. Was just in northern Sumatra. It was different in all the many islands, of the country, the genocide played out differently, but they can look at this and talk about it and get mad, and it's a kind of trigger, almost.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, I didn't see the film, but I heard an interview on NPR.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Great.
And they were, I mean, the things they were saying were that, you know, the reenactors were very, the people who had been the perpetrators were really into it, but a lot of the people who were brought in to play the parts just got sick from the reenactments, I mean, physically
but
ill.
The perpetrators have no sensitivity to that at all. Someone behind you had a question,
Well, I have a comment first, and then I want a question. The comment is sort of an anecdote about, filmmaker Errol Morris did a movie about the genocide, but,
About what? Which genocide?
About the Holocaust. About the Holocaust denier. Mm-hmm. And so I spent 2 weeks with him and his crew in Auschwitz and Birkenau, and one of the things I found out was that when Spielberg made his movie, all he wanted to do was park a locomotive outside the gate of Birkenau and shoot it, and they would not allow it because they didn't know or didn't trust what he would do with it. Mm-hmm. But when Errol Morris showed up, because of the movies that he made, they gave him the keys to the archive room.
No.
So that we went to, there was no place we could not go because of his reputation.
Isn't that amazing? Oh, instead of Spielberg's.
I thought you would like that.
Yeah.
but as I told you earlier, my daughter and I, I'm Armenian. We're doing a 2015 is the 100th anniversary of the beginning of the Armenian genocide, which is denied by Turkey. And the basis of our movie is not to all the documentaries that have been made so far argue that it happened because it's being denied by Turkey. Our film talks about the effect of the denial on Armenians living in the diaspora. And I just want to ask you this. So the basis of the premise of our movie is that genocide scholars agree that denial is the final act of genocide. Mm-hmm. It's the killing of the memory. So it's not just the killing of the people, but it's the killing of the memory, which denies the group, Armenians in this case, any kind of place, moral place in the world. So the movie is about my family, my parents, me, my daughter, their generation, there's lots of, the point is that this is a group who's traumatized in a way which I have never seen before. And you don't have to know that you're traumatized to be affected by it. I wonder what you think about that comment, the comment that genocide scholars make, that denial is the second act of genocide.
You mean, and there's more afterwards?
Or
the final?
What we say.
Good.
It says that, and this is what the denial of genocide is the final stage of genocide. The first killing, followed by the killing of the memory of the killing. The perpetrator's quest for impunity by denying continues to abuse the victim group by preventing the process of healing for the survivors and the inheritors of the survivors. So in effect, the genocide hasn't stopped for Armenians. Mm-hmm. It goes on every day, whether they want to talk about it. And in my family, my grandparents didn't talk to my parents didn't talk to me, and I didn't talk to my daughter. And that's true for Armenian families everywhere. Not all Armenian families, but some do.
It seems to me to be completely accurate that people, you can't ever get over it if it's not talked about and realized. I'm so glad you're making this movie. The Armenians have been just brilliant at making their genocide remembered, making sure that it's a topic. Maybe it wasn't discussed in your family, but there's now, have you been to the Greenway in Boston? The new Armenian memorial there is fabulous.
And they talk about it politically, they want recognition from people, okay, but they don't talk about it within their family, so it's not taught.
Yeah.
That's the premise
yeah.
of the movie.
Yeah.
And it's true. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't talk about their own stories. And the telling of it is where the healing is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was going to ask you just to talk about that.
And I think that that takes decades. I mean, it takes a long time.
This is 100 years.
Yeah, it takes a long time.
A really long time.
I went to Germany with my husband, Otto, sitting over there, and we spent time with different family members, and by the end of the night, or after several hours together, they would finally practically be bursting
mm-hmm.
to talk about this, and it was just amazing all this time afterwards. It's less than 100 years, but that they felt finally free enough to go into their story. And I remember your cousin talking about how blown away he was by some of these Holocaust images. I think they were shown on the BBC or something, and it was the first time he'd seen it, you know. But something was happening in Germany. It was a couple of years ago, a few years back, where everybody seemed to be, there was some kind of release going on.
Yeah.
Which maybe happens
that's
periodically, or I'm sure I'm not saying anything surprising, but it was such a direct encounter with that.
The auto J of people there.
Yeah. I'd also like to point to a, for me, very revealing psychological moment in the second film, which has to do with what Nadine said. Although here, in a more individualized, totally individualized way, this man who was asked whether how many people he killed, and I think the art, if one can say art of the second film, although I hate to bring together the word art and genocide, but anyway. What I seem to see is that in this man who was asked how many people he killed, there was a real struggle going on between shame, what one might call shame, and relief to be able to speak about it, or to at least admit that he, it wasn't many, it was just one, but so I think individually, psychologically, that is one thing that's going on in those who remember and are asked to remember atrocities they have witnessed or even partaken in. And it seemed to me also the film, the second film, the first film just looked at things from the outside, as if it was an object. But the second film showed that in order for somebody to become able to get into this struggle in the first place, that really is not easy.
Mm.
And as the filmmaker said in the second film, it took me many years. I had to get to know these people and they had to trust me. And so there is so much in it, I can't even spell it out, but I just wanted to, perhaps, I'm sure you too saw that, I just had to speak about it.
Go, I don't know who.
Thanks, Jack. You know, the focus is on, you know, memory and what Noubar's talking about, the denial of what happened. People ask in, I think both of the films, and ask in general, how could it happen? I mean, what was the thinking? And I think that gets back to the idea of eugenics, and that a certain group of people is causing our problems, whether it's communists in Indonesia or Hutus in Rwanda, Jews and gay people and gypsies and mentally so-called retarded people in Germany. And I think until until that connection gets made, that there is still, I think very strongly, an idea that we can identify through science.